From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. The best way to support the show is by booking a Disneyland, Walt Disney World, Disney Cruise Line, or Adventures by Disney vacation with Dreams Unlimited Travel. Get a free, no-obligation quote today for your next dream vacation at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hey there, hi there, ho there, and welcome to episode 290 of Connecting with Walt. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my co-host, executive producer, and good friend, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm okay. How are you, Michael?
Oh, I'm doing well. You survived the eclipse?
I barely, you know, I kept wanting to look up at it, and everyone around me kept assuring me that that would be terrible for my eyes, but it's also hard to resist. You're like, well, is it, you know, am I going to look in the right place when I put those glasses on? It's like, I think I need to check with my own eyes just to be sure. But yeah, I made it out unscathed.
Oh, good, good. It was, I think I saw your photo from the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah, that's where I went to check it out. So we had a good little view. I was able to take some interesting photos of it from like the Tron Light Cycle Run area, and you know, kind of have the partial eclipse that we had kind of angled right in between the spires of Cinderella Castle. So I got unique shots out of it, but you know, it's we had like a 60% eclipse at the peak, so it wasn't like the most exciting thing in the world. I feel like the last total eclipse we had, ours was maybe like 80% or so, and maybe even a little bit more than that. That one was a little bit more exciting because felt like, oh gosh, it's almost all the way there. But this one just it wasn't as impressive, but it's always impressive.
We had about 40% here. It was not, it wasn't that impressive.
Yeah. We got a little bit of the light like going down in the surrounding area. Like you could definitely tell like, oh, this is a little dim, a little shaded. So I got a kick out of that, but I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that I stay healthy and keep my residence or get a better residence in the same area until 2045 when we actually have the total eclipse in Orlando. But
well, that next one, I thought it was 2044 here. It's on my birthday. So it gives me something to live for.
Yeah.
And it goes over Sacramento.
Yeah. It's, all the way across over to Orlando, which is just wild that it's crossing so much, and, gonna be pretty exciting. But yeah, I'm still being kind of muted about it because August in Florida will probably end up having thunderstorms that completely cover it up, but I can hope.
Yeah, but I thought, wow, that's amazing on my birthday. So who knows? Maybe they'll interview me as like the oldest man watching the eclipse or something.
Oh, I can't imagine you'll be the oldest at that point. So it's exciting.
It is. It is. This week, we welcome back Disney historian, author, artist, filmmaker, and friend of Connecting with Walt, Dave Bossert. Dave has more than 40 years of experience in the animation industry, with 32 of them at the Walt Disney Company. He contributed his talents to several films, including The Black Cauldron, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, The Lion King, Fantasia 2000, and Destino. He is the author of many unique books, which include Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, The Search for the Lost Disney Cartoons, Kem Weber, Mid-Century Furniture Designs for the Disney Studios, Claude Coates, Walt Disney's Imagineer, The Making of Disneyland, and The House of the Future, Walt Disney, MIT, and Monsanto's Vision of Tomorrow, amongst others. Today, Dave is joining us to talk about his latest book, Find Your Happy Place, The 8-Step Guide to Boosting Your Creativity Through a Personal Retreat. Dave, welcome back to Connecting with Walt.
Michael and Craig, thank you so much for having me back on the show. I always enjoy visiting with you guys.
Oh, thank you. We're delighted that you could come back. And to talk about a really unique book, this sort of outside the Disney sort of realm this time.
It is a little bit outside the Disney realm, but it also, I like to tell people that it's because of Disney I've written this book.
Good. And well, because as we'll get into it, what you write about is a way that we can unleash our imagination and our creativity through this.
Exactly.
So let's start out by saying, what is a personal retreat?
Well, I view a personal retreat, as time by yourself to find focus and clarity and to deep think. And it's something that a lot of people don't do for themselves in this day and age. It's something I've been doing for more than 30 years, Michael.
And so what inspired you then to write about your experiences on your personal retreat?
Well, first and foremost, it's a personal retreat, and it's something that I've been doing every single year for more than 30 years, and it's highly personal. And I never thought I would write anything about it, but I started to get a lot of friends and family and acquaintances who kind of got a sense of what I was doing every year, asking me more about it. And also, I actually had a few people tell me I should write a book about it. And thanks to the pandemic, when we were all cooped up in our homes, I had a lot of time to do a lot of writing and on a lot of different projects, and this one in particular.
Great. So what is the purpose and benefit of a personal retreat?
Well, for me, the big benefit is that it allows you to have a certain amount of time to completely unplug from the world, to actually be by yourself. And I don't say that lightly, Michael, because oftentimes, we don't have that ability to really unplug, turn off the phone, unplug the computer, and go sit by yourself without any distractions, without interruptions. I don't think a lot of people, I personally believe a lot of people would have trouble shutting their phone off for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. Because I think we're in a world of, people missing out. They don't want to miss out on things. They want to know stuff right away. And those are all distractions as far as I'm concerned. And so for me, It's a very personal thing to be able to sit and be completely by yourself. And I talk about this in the book, where you can let your mind run without somebody sitting there distracting you or telling you you can't do that or that's crazy. I go into a lot of this in the book.
Yeah. I think that's so important now because we're hearing studies. Some came out this week, in fact, about how young people are, they're somehow connected. They're on their iPads or their phones or something. The minute they're home from school, for like 8, 10, 12 hours, and how the suicide rates are increasing. Their levels of anxiety are increasing. their social interaction is decreasing, the personal social interaction. And then, you know, they're getting all these dopamine hits and endorphin hits in their brains, but, and it's affecting, you know, they can't read books anymore because they don't have the attention span. They can't sit that long because they need that dopamine hit. They can't watch like the movies we grew up with because they're too slow for them.
Right.
So I think what you're talking about, unplugging, I think it's vital for like people's mental health and well-being these days.
I completely agree with you, Michael. I think, you know, you have to be able to condition yourself to put down the phone, to walk away from the electronic devices. And, you know, for me, when I go off on my personal retreat, which is typically a week or more, I'm by myself. I have a couple of books. I have some articles I may have printed out that I want to read. And I sit by myself. My phone, I have a phone with me, but I shut it off, you know, because I just feel as though, you know, I'm okay for being, you know, 4 or 5 hours at a clip with my phone shut off. I'm able to actually sit in a very quiet place, you know, without being bothered by anybody and being able to actually think clearly without distractions and to think through not only thoughts, but think about ideas of things you want to do. How would you go about doing it? You know, sitting there and pondering an idea for 2 or 3 hours. We don't really get that opportunity to do that on a daily basis. And that's what this personal retreat is all about for me. And I think it could really benefit a lot of other people.
Yeah. And in your book, you make a distinction between solitude and loneliness. Because, you know, nowadays, young people and adults say that they are more lonely than ever, even though they're on their phones all the time. So can you talk about that, the difference between the two?
Yeah, I really focused on that, as you well know, because you've read the book. I really pointed out and made it a point to talk about the fact that being alone is different from loneliness. Loneliness is a mental health issue today. And there's an awful lot of people who are feeling lonely and disconnected in the world. And those people need to go address that. They need to talk to a professional, maybe talk to a therapist. But I'm talking about being alone, where you're planning to go off by yourself, whether that's hiking up in the mountains to a favorite spot where you can spend the day, or like I do, I go up into, you know, the very northern reaches of Maine every year in a sparsely populated area, and I have a spot I go to where I can be by myself and be surrounded by beautiful nature. Not just the, you know, looking out at the water, but sitting and hearing the leaves rustling through the trees, you know, and hearing, you know, a lobster boat motoring along off in the distance, or the halyards clanging on a mast, like church bells. You know, these are things I describe in the book, and that to me is a purposeful, place to be alone and to sit in thought, as opposed to the feelings of loneliness that people experience.
Mm-hmm. So, and I've been on religious retreats, and there's a lot of similarities between what you describe as a personal retreat and a religious retreat in terms of the introspection and meditation.
Yes. And you know, the difference here is that I've not been on a religious retreat, but from what I've read about them, you know, religious retreats are communing with God and with other people doing the same thing. And again, my book is about a personal retreat that you mm-hmm. take by yourself. And that doesn't mean that God isn't part of it. You can sit on your own personal retreat and commune with God as well. But I'm talking more about the creativity, that you have inside yourself and releasing that creativity and also using your imagination. So there is differences, but there are also are similarities.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how do you plan for a personal retreat?
Well, you know, what I lay out in the book is you know, each individual step. And to plan for this, you really have to focus in on when you can take the time, blocking that time on your calendar. As I've mentioned, Michael, I already have my personal retreat planned for later this year. It's been planned since January. I've already purchased my plane ticket to fly up to Boston. I've already reserved my rental car to drive up into Maine. I have my accommodations reserved. So I've done all of the work in January and I have it blocked on my calendar. So when somebody reaches out to me and say, if you called me up, if you and Craig reached out and said, Dave, we want to have you on for a podcast interview the third week of September, I'd say, sorry, guys, I am out of town. I can't do that because I have this blocked on my calendar already. And as you can imagine, you know, I have, you know, obligations and requests that are on my calendar going out to late December already of this year, you know? So it's imperative for me and it's imperative for anybody who wants to do a personal retreat to block it on their calendar at least 6 or 8 months in advance, because that way you have it set in stone and you tell people, you know, you tell your loved ones, your family, this is when I'm going to go and do this. And I can't move this now because I've made all of the reservations and I've paid for everything. So this is set in stone. So anything you want to do, we have to work around that. And by the way, it's effective by doing it that far in advance.
Oh, I'll bet. Especially because, like you said, there is some planning that has to go into it. So I thought you mentioned that there are steps and you go into great detail in the steps in the book, but I thought maybe let's take a high level overview of the steps to give folks an idea as to what goes into a personal retreat. So the first step you mentioned is how much time and when to take it. And the nice thing is this book is like a workbook where you have, worksheets at the end of every chapter with questions to help with planning, goal setting, and even doing personal debriefs afterwards. So this is really helpful.
Yes. And I will tell you that not only are the worksheets in the book, we're in the process of putting those worksheets as PDFs onto a specific website so that people can download those and print them out. So if you A, don't want to write in the book, or B, you prefer to have more space to write things down or to do something every year like I do, I find it, you know, something that I wanted to make available to people for free. It's going to be up on a website in a few months, and they'll be able to download those worksheets.
Okay, that's great. So let's take a look at step one. Can you sort of talk a little about that? How much time and when to take it?
Yeah. So, you know, the time factor is something that's very squishy. You can take as little time or as much time, and everybody's different. You know, some people might not be able to do a full week. I've been fortunate in that I've done a week, I've done 2 weeks, I've done as much as 3 weeks, if you can believe it. But I think 3 weeks is sort of pushing the limit for me. I find the sweet spot to be 2 weeks, but That doesn't mean you can't take 2 days. It doesn't mean you can't do this in a weekend, or maybe break it up where you do 2 or 3 mini retreats during the year where you do a Saturday and a Sunday. And again, everybody has different obligations and, they have different budgets. And you know, when you talk about your happy place, you know, you have to sit there and think to yourself, what's that one place that I can go to where I just feel at ease? I feel happy. I feel safe. You know, that's an individual choice. For me, many, many years ago, it was Maine. Why Maine? I grew up on Long Island in New York. My parents would take us as children, myself and my siblings, into New England for vacations. And so there's a visceral meaning to me of where I go. So what is that visceral meaning or place that you want to go to? And everybody's going to be different. And that's something I really stress. And so I really talk about, you know, where to go and, really, you know, how much time. It's really about the time that you put into this. And it's about being alone in your thoughts without those distractions, whether that's a day, 2 days, a week, or more.
Mm-hmm. And then that leads us into where to take your retreat. And that's step 2.
Yeah. And I spend a little bit of time on this because, again, mm-hmm. there, you know, what I do for my personal retreat may not work for you or for Craig or for anyone else. But, you know, you have to determine where you're going to go. You know, what's that one place that's going to make you feel good? And feel comfortable and that you, have, you know, enough amenities. And when I say amenities, I'm talking, you know, is there enough of an infrastructure in place that makes you feel comfortable? I like to go into a very remote part of Maine where there's a very low population of people. I have to drive, you know, 20 minutes or 25 minutes to get to a store, you know, like a grocery store or a restaurant. So that to me works for me. That might not work for other people. And I give a lot of great examples in the book. And one of the things I do talk about, also taking a class, if you will. You know, is there something you've always wanted to do? My retreat always works as a I arrive in Maine and there's a little coastal school that's seasonal. It's open from May until October. And I always take a class for a week. And you may say, well, why do you do that? Well, first off, I want to learn something new. So I want to take a class and learn a skill that I may never use again. I talk about this in the book because one summer I went up to do my personal retreat and I took a week long class on making oars, rowing oars, right? I don't even mm-hmm. own a boat, but I wanted to learn how to make oars. And there's something about learning a new skill that unleashes some creativity in your mind. And again, I talk about this later in the book when I talk about creativity. So for me, I start out with a class that helps me wind down from my normal work week and personal life, taking that class. And then following that class, I take a week where I am by myself. I am immersed in my thoughts and all of those things are happening based on where I'm taking my retreat. Now, these little, seasonal schools, they're all over the country. And I give a lot of great examples because if there was something you wanted to try, do you want to learn how to weave a basket? Do you want to, you know, make prints? Do you want to learn how to paint? Or do you want to take a photography class? You know, there's all of these kinds of classes all over the country. And it's just not about mastering the skill. It's about trying it, seeing if you like it. Maybe you take a class on bookbinding. Since we're talking about books, there's a place in Colorado where you can do that. You can learn how to bind a book. Well, you know, you may only do it once, but it's something that you experience. It's like people going off and making their own bottle of wine or making beer. You know, it's those types of experiences that you've always wanted to try, and maybe you'll fall in love with it and want to pursue it and do more, or maybe you just want to try it and do it once. But that's a component of my personal retreat and something I talk quite a bit about.
I think that's important too, because again, I was just listening to a study again this week about their learning that in order to fight off dementia in Alzheimer's in later age, they're saying one of the things that's important to do is, as when you're younger and in middle age, is to push your brain, make your brain hurt by learning new skills, doing things that maybe are difficult out of your comfort zone. Maybe that's doing puzzles or whatever. But I think, like you were saying, learning something new like that that you've never done before falls right into that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I tell people I'm a lifelong learner. I'm always taking classes. You know, Michael, when I first wrote my first book about, remembering Roy E. Disney, I didn't know really what I was doing. I had a lot of people helping and guiding me. And then when I finished that book, I pitched the idea of doing the Destino book, and they said, yes, we want to do this. So I was doing my second book, and I decided, you know what? I'm going to enroll at the UCLA Writers Program. And I did. And I went through a whole series of courses in the Writers Program, and I wound up getting a certificate in creative writing and also a certificate in fiction writing. Because I enjoyed the classes so much. So it opened up a whole new world to me. And by the way, this book is my 13th book, not including special editions. If I include the special editions, it's like 15, you know? So I kind of feel like, you know, if I went back 25 years and you said to me, do you think you'll ever write a book? I would have laughed and said, oh my gosh, I don't think I'll ever write a book. And here I am. I've written 13 books.
That's, you know, wonderful. And congratulations.
And a lot of it, by the way, has been an outgrowth of my personal retreats, because on one of my retreats about 15 or 18 years ago, I wrote a list. I sat at an old decrepit picnic table on the coast of Maine in the middle of no place with a composition notebook. And I wrote longhand in that notebook, a list of books I would like to write. And I just let my mind go. And you know, I wrote down a title and I put a sentence or two of what I thought that book would be about. And guess what? I've crossed off a lot of those books on that list. And in subsequent years, I've been adding more titles to it. So
that is great.
To me, that's, you know, that's an outgrowth of me taking these personal retreats.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things when you say, oh, I've, you know, choose a happy place, people are going to say Walt Disney World, that they'll go to the parks for a week and then they'll hang out at one of the resorts by themselves for a week. And you actually address that in the book.
Why,
that might not be the best place to go.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's resorts that are, you know, promoting retreats, where they're structured, you know, where you're going to do trust falls or walk on hot coals or some such thing. That's not the retreat I'm talking about. This is something very different. It's highly personal. It's something that you customize to yourself, and it's something anyone can do, and you can do it with the any amount of time you want, because it really is about being able to be alone in a space where you're not going to be interrupted, that will allow you to really go into deep thought, whether that's about, you know, your career, your life, your relationships, whatever it is. But to have that time to be able to focus on those things, that's what's important.
Mm-hmm. And that goes into step three, setting realistic goals and achieving them. And you're using a program that I know I used when I was working that is SMART in
the
order
SMART
to.
Process. That's
yeah.
Right.
I think a lot of people are familiar with that.
Yeah. Specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time bound goals. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, this is where you're going to, you know, make some notes to yourself as to what are the things you want to think about while you're on your retreat. You know, I've been doing it long enough that when I get up there, I can sit down and just let my mind wander until it focuses in on something and then really think about that, you know, and what's important about that, and I can't stress this enough, is that we all have a facade to us, you know, and a lot of people are very self-conscious. You know, they, you know, don't want to admit that, but they are. But being able to sit by yourself and to laugh, to cry, to think of outlandish things, to talk to yourself with no one around, you know, that's not insanity. That's sanity, right? Because mm-hmm. you're allowing yourself the time to just think and connect the dots and figure out how you can do something, what you want to do with your career, where you'd like to go, you know, what's your relationships like, you know, and how often do we get that opportunity? Now, somebody may say, well, I go to my therapist once a week and I do that for an hour, you know, but this is very different from that, you know, and I'm more power to people who go to therapists, and I think they're very helpful, but this is a very different thing than doing that. And I think it's hugely important. So being able to set those realistic goals and figuring out how you're going to achieve them is an important part of it. And I'm not talking about setting a goal like, hey, I want to go to the moon, you know, in 5 years, you know. Well, I'm sorry, that may not happen. But I'm talking realistic goals, you know, how can you get that promotion, change jobs, decide to leave your job and go do something else. You know, what's the plan you need to put together to do that? And being able to take those kind of complex goals and break them down into small chunks so that they're measurable. You can say, I'm going to do this step and get that done, and I'll move on to this next piece. All with the idea that you're going to reach the main goal.
Mm-hmm. Good. And then step four, and this is interesting because this is something that was popular a few years ago, journaling your intention and goals. So why is it important to keep the journal?
Well, I've been journaling for decades, you know, and I can look over on my shelf and I have a whole bunch of notebooks there, and I have a whole bunch of notebooks in boxes and in storage. But to me, it's really important to write things down that you want to do. It makes them real. Mm-hmm. There's also, you know, the idea, and I talk about this in the book, about the actual art of writing. You know, I mean, you know, Michael, people aren't writing anymore, you know, and there's actually a creativity to being able to put pen or pencil to paper and write out words and string those words together into sentences And I think it's important to be able to sit while you're on the retreat and write in a notebook. You don't have to worry about where the power outlet is. You don't have to worry about the battery draining on your computer. You're sitting there quietly, like I do, at a picnic table with a 49-cent college-ruled notebook that I buy in bulk, you know, six at a time. And you're writing down your thoughts. And it doesn't matter what you write in there because it's really only for you to see, you know. And that's, you know, people, again, I think there's, you know, what if somebody sees this? What if somebody reads this? You know, well, first off, it's a personal notebook. It's yours. You know, you can fill it up and then toss it in the fireplace if you want to. You know, look, I think that there's a certain amount of creative, juices that are released when you're actually writing on paper, as opposed to typing away on a keyboard, or, you know, texting or whatever. You know, I think there's a lost art to actually penmanship.
Oh, there absolutely is.
Yeah, yeah. And that visceral feeling of the pen or pencil gliding across the paper and forming those words and thoughts that, you know, you're putting down on the paper. So I think it's a hugely important part of, you know, is writing longhand, and helping to, you know, stimulate, the creativity within your brain, you know?
And I think writing longhand gives you time to form your thoughts as well. But, and it's funny because I was a teacher I started out in the primary grades, and my son, the teacher, started out in the primary grades, but we're different generations. So when we talked about, okay, when I taught the children to write, you know, I talked about them getting their whole body involved in writing. We would do exercises. We'd make big circles in the air with our arms before we learned how to make the O's and all this stuff. And of course, I taught cursive, which isn't even taught in schools now. My granddaughter doesn't know cursive at all. Well, that's why I write to her in cursive. Really? So she's going to learn this somehow. And then my son, he talks about how he's teaching them on iPads. And they don't even have textbooks or anything. Everything's on the iPad.
Yeah. Which is, you know, I think there's things getting lost there. And really it's not for the good. I hope they bring back cursive in schools at some point because there's a benefit to your creativity by actually writing on paper.
And there's something about that control as well.
Yeah.
That controlling your arm, your movements, and that fine motor coordination skill develops a part of the brain that isn't getting developed when they're typing on the keyboard.
Or texting with their fingers.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I agree with you.
Yeah. And that leads us to step five. You talk about healthy mind and healthy body.
Absolutely. Again, you know, to me, this is hugely important because a component of taking a personal retreat is what are you going to eat? You know, you're not going to go do the drive through at McDonald's for every meal, because I don't think that's healthy personally. But you may be in an area where there isn't a McDonald's to do a drive through, you know, so you have to figure out what your meal plan is. You know, I stay in a boarding house that has two meals a day, and they make sandwiches at lunch that are grab and go. So I get home cooking, you know, that's sort of farm to table type of cooking, whatever's available in the area during the time of year that I'm there. I think that, you know, it's an opportunity for you to go someplace and actually change your daily habits. Not only in what you're consuming, but also in getting exercise, being out in nature, you know, whether that's just walking along the beach in a particular area, or taking a hike through the woods, or just walking places as opposed to having to drive. And that's what I do when I go on my personal retreat, is that I'm very conscious of the type of food I'm eating. And that has spilled over, by the way, Michael, in over the years that I've been taking my personal retreat, my diet, my eating habits have shifted over many years. And I generally eat healthy. I'm not vegetarian, but you know, this is an opportunity where you could go vegetarian for a week or a couple of days if you wanted to try that. This is an opportunity for you to get into the mode of, just doing some walking. You know, walking's some of the most healthy thing, you know, one of the most healthy things you can do. You don't have to go running. You don't have to ride a Peloton or you know, lift weights. You could just go for a walk if that's what you want to do to get exercise. And I do talk about that quite a bit in that chapter, and cite some great examples of very creative people who, you know, go for walks or who went for walks during their lifetime on a regular basis to help spark their creative juices. So mm-hmm. I think that's, to me, a hugely important thing.
Yeah, that was a really interesting chapter. I enjoyed it. I liked all the references to people that we would know in history as well as current. Yeah, that was a good one. Now, step six talks about your actual retreat and getting the most out of it. And what I really enjoyed is how you talked about making dreams more productive.
Yes.
Because my dreams are nuts, but yours, it was really interesting what the process that you talk about in here.
You know, all I can do is impart what's working for me. And some people may say, well, that doesn't work, or that sounds crazy to me. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I impart in this chapter what I actually do on my retreat and how I get the most out of it. And I do talk about dreams, because oftentimes, and I've read this, and I'm sure you have, Michael, over the years, that a lot of times, if you just ask yourself a question before you go to sleep mm-hmm. and think about that for a moment, your subconscious goes to work while you're sleeping. And a lot of people don't really think about that, or maybe don't understand it, but your subconscious controls an awful lot that is going on with you. You know, you're breathing, you know, and just all of those involuntary type of processes going on in your body that you're not sitting there saying, oh, I have to take a breath right now. Oh, I have to take another breath to keep alive. You know, these are automatic things that's going on in your subconscious mind. And I find that when I go to sleep, if there's something that I've been thinking about during the day and I'm searching for an answer, I'll think about that right before I go to bed. I'll ask myself, you know, how can I solve this problem? And 9 times out of 10, I wake up the next morning and there's almost an epiphany moment. You know, mm-hmm. The answer comes to you. It floods into you because your subconscious mind is working while you're sleeping. And so I swear by it. And I lay this out very well, I think, in the chapter. You seem to have enjoyed it, which made me feel good.
Oh, absolutely. It was very good about lucid dreaming. And also you got into the importance of daydreaming in there as well. So
absolutely. And I, you know, again, and this will probably lead us into step seven, the creative thinking. and step eight, visualization, because I have to say that, you know, these look, all of these things work in concert together. And it's amazing when you understand them, what you can get out of all of this. And again, the creative thinking, you know, I read a lot of medical papers, and research on creativity and creative thinking and how it works. And I lay that out, you know, in a reasonable amount of detail in the book, because, you could go down a rabbit hole on some of this stuff, and it's more than I think the average person really needs. But there's an understanding you should have of this, because it is kind of magical.
It is. It definitely is. And so that does, when you talk about creative thinking too, some of the things you stress in the book, how this unleashes your imagination, it can relieve stress. And what was really fascinating is you get into the eight types of imagination, which was new to me. I had no idea. So
yeah, and all of that stems from a lot of research that was done in Europe, and I did a lot of research on it for this book because I really wanted people to sort of have a basic understanding of how your imagination works and how you're taking crumbs of ideas, things that you've been exposed to, or something you read, or things that you may have learned in a class, and all of these things start to connect to one another. You start to connect these dots, and these experiences and these ideas that you have start to come together if you allow them to, if you're conscious of it, if you let your mind go. You know, I don't know about you, but I'm one of these people that when I see something mechanical, I'm interested in knowing how it works. You know, how does this thing work that does this other thing? And you know, even the simplest thing about, like, you get a box in, you know, a package in the mail, and taking the box apart and flattening it out, you know, and understanding how they designed that box so that it folded a certain way. Mm-hmm. I notice a lot of those things that many of us just take for granted every day. And I'm curious about those things. And I sit there, I don't spend an exorbitant amount of time on them, but I tuck those things away because when I'm writing on a project, you know, an idea comes to you and you start connecting these crumbs of information you've accumulated over your lifetime. And all of a sudden you have that moment of like, aha, what if I did this? You know, and those come from all of this stuff you're absorbing on a daily basis, you know, and allowing yourself to notice. One of the greatest compliments somebody gave me was on my Kem Weber book. He said, I am somebody who notices the things most people don't notice, you know, and I thought that was a great compliment, you know, and that's partly, you know, I have to say, is sort of the foundation of a lot of the books I've written, you know. Like my, you know, Kem Weber furniture book, you know, the Disney animation furniture, you know, most people wouldn't notice that furniture, you know, or try to, you know, write a book about the furniture and the fact that the furniture has a bit of a soul to it and that it was developed by artists with an industrial designer, you know, so. You know, those kinds of things are underpinnings for me and are things that have come out of my personal retreats.
Well, and it's true. You never know what curiosity may lead you to. I mean, there's the famous story that, how audio animatronics got started. Walt was curious about how a little mechanical bird he purchased in New Orleans worked. And I think it was Wathel Rogers he gave it to and said, figure out how this works. And Wathel explained it to him. And that led to the amazing attractions we have in the parks now.
Right, so, right. Yeah. And they keep improving upon and as technology advances, you know. Yeah. So that whole chapter, step 7 on creative thinking, I think is an eye-opener for people. And I don't think we have the time to go through every single step.
No.
but I think that people are going to get a lot out of that chapter by understanding, you know, their affectuative imagination, their intellectual or constructive imagination, and how all of those things interlink to one another.
I think this is worth the price of the book, just that eight types of imagination section. I found it really, really interesting.
Thank you for that. I appreciate
you're welcome.
It. And the final step is visualization. And I'll just give you my real world of this, okay? Because, you know, some people sit there and go, oh, you know, what am I going to do? Visualize winning the lottery, you know? No. When I was animating at Walt Disney Animation Studios all those years, working on films like Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Who Framed Roger Rabbit and so on, in my office, I had a Chem Weber airline chair, little leather recliner. And when I was cast a scene, I'd meet with, you know, the director or the head of the department and go over a scene that I had to do special effects animation for. I'd go back to my office with that scene, put it on my desk, and I'd sit in my chair with my eyes closed. And it could be for hours. I might blow an entire morning. And I would visualize in my mind's eye exactly what that scene needed to look like, how I needed to do the animation for that scene. And when I had a very, very clear vision of that in my mind, that's when I sat at my desk and started to animate and I put pencil to paper, you know, and I would say more often than not, 90% of the time, I nailed it the first time through for the director. Nobody's 100%, but that to me is a huge part of this, is to visualize yourself doing something, to visualize yourself having the success at whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. And I think, you know, part of it really, Michael, is if you're going to, you have to believe in yourself before anyone else is going to believe in you. And that's just not, you know, a catchphrase. That's the reality of this. And one of the things I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. And visualization really is a part of every one of these steps as well.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They're all interlocking, I think. And a lot of these things are happening concurrently. So, you know, it's a matter of conditioning yourself to be able to do that. And by the way, I don't buy it when somebody says, oh, I'm not creative at all. We're all creative. It's just a matter that some people have developed their creativity more than others. But everyone can be creative and everyone has the capacity to be creative in their own way. You just have to allow yourself to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes me feel better. Anyway, now for me, one of the problems I have is that I get distracted. I have a wandering mind. So on the retreat, do you have any tips for maintaining focus?
Well, I will tell you that when you go on the trip, you want your mind to wander. you absolutely do want it to wander, because you want to wander through your thoughts until you hit on something that you want to spend some time thinking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hugely important. Look, once you've finished your retreat, you really want to use those worksheets or your notebook that you've been writing in as sort of your roadmap. You know, you want to go back to it on a daily or weekly basis and review where you are on accomplishing the things you want to do. I use my retreat every year not only to review the things I did over the past 12 months, but the things I want to do in the next 12 months. You know, and do I think about where I want to be in 5 or 10 years? Yeah, I do that too. But I really have focused in on where was I 12 months ago? My last retreat, what were the goals I set for myself? Have I accomplished those goals? Which ones didn't I accomplish yet? And will I continue to work at those, or am I going to change that goal or adjust that goal or, you know, do something different in the next 12 months? And, it's all within your control. You can do this if you want to do it. You have to focus in on that ability in you to do this. And it requires work. And I'm sad to say that I think there's a lot of people today who don't want to work at anything. They just, you know, they want to be a YouTube star, or, you know, they want to be a billionaire, but, you know, they don't know how they want to do that. They want to dance in front of their phone and post dancing videos on TikTok because they want to be an influencer, mm-hmm. you know, and some of them will, you know, I'm not knocking it. There are some people who will become influencers, but not everybody's going to be, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And that was my question. I think you sort of answered it, is when you return to normal life after your personal retreat, how do you sort of maintain these positive effects and a focus? And it really is, that's why you have the journals and the worksheets. That's why I guess it's so crucial to make those a part of your personal retreat.
I think it works because you're writing it down. And it's something that makes you accountable when you go back and look at it. You know, what have I done to further, you know, this particular goal? What have I done today or this week to make that happen? And I think, you know, again, it's about disciplining yourself to be able to do these things. And if you do, and there's plenty of people out there in the world who do that, they go on to greatness. It may not be public greatness. It may be personal greatness. You know, they accomplish things in their personal lives that they want to accomplish. And I think that's hugely important.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, everything that we've talked about, you know, it goes back when I said, oh, well, you know, it's sort of out of the Disney realm. You mentioned it isn't. Well, we all talk about, you know, Walt, people say Walt was a dreamer. He was one of the most creative people that they knew. Well, this is a way, your book is where we can unleash that creativity that is in us, that we can find it and develop it and then build on it and set our goals to develop our own creativity and imagination.
Oh, no, I completely agree with you. And, you know, if you look at somebody like Walt Disney, you know, they thought he was crazy for trying to do a feature-length animated film, mm-hmm. you know, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He proved them wrong. They thought he was crazy to try and open up an amusement park, especially thought he was nuts that he wasn't going to have a Midway, but he was going to have Main Street. You know, there were people in the amusement business telling him he had to have a Midway with carnival barkers and games that are rigged to rip off people. And so he'd make a lot of money. And that's exactly what he didn't want to do. And I think, you know, he had in his head what he wanted Disneyland to be. And he famously, you know, sequestered himself with
John Hitch.
No,
Herb Ryman,
you know, for a couple of day weekend to actually come up with the visualization of that so he could pitch it to sponsors, you know, and, you know, again, it's about, you know, when you look at somebody like Walt, you know, he believed in himself, you know, in my Claude Coates book, I wrote, where the expression, isn't it fun to do the impossible came from. Mm-hmm. And that was, he said that to Claude Coates in the hallway of the studio when Claude told him that something he was trying to do that, you know, the,
oh, the colors in the mind changing nature's wonderland, the
rainbow caverns,
yeah.
how to keep the colors separate so they wouldn't turn to mud when they came down off the waterfall. And, Hans Haber, the German rocket scientist, told Claude it was statistically impossible to do that. And he conveyed that to Walt, and Walt just looked at him and said, well, Claude, isn't it fun to do the impossible? And walked away. You know, it was sort of like, figure it out. Mm-hmm. Right?
So yeah, that is, know, exactly what he meant. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that those kinds of stories are not only inspiring, but they're also, you know, lessons for us to learn that, you know, if you are laser focused on wanting to do something with your life or start a business or something, you have to believe in yourself and make those things happen. It's really that simple. And I think that this book really lays out a roadmap for people to get into that mindset. And so even though it's not about Disney history, it is kind of connected in a way to my experiences at the Walt Disney Company and the things I learned while I was there from the history of Disney and right. Walt.
Yeah. And I think it's developing your own personal qualities so that you can, so that you can be creative. So, and yeah, have a guide for your life.
Absolutely. No matter what you're doing, this, you know, I feel like I am a happier person. I'm a more positive person. I continue to go through my life and the ups and downs we all experience. You know, I mean, nobody has 100% perfect life. You know, we all have setbacks and we have, you know, losses and things that happen, but it's how you deal with all of those. You know, again, another Walt story. If you go back to my Oswald the Lucky Rabbit book, you know, Walt didn't own Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. When he found that out, that was kind of a gut punch to him because he was going to lose the contract. And, you know, that's a life lesson to somebody. And some people would have just walked away and sat on a bar stool for the rest of their life, bitching and complaining about how they got screwed, you know? And what did Walt do? Walt said, oh, I'm going to own all of my characters going forward, and I'm going to come up with a new character, and it's going to be the greatest character ever. And he creates Mickey Mouse with Ub Iwerks. They create the three shorts, one of which, Steamboat Willie's, the first sound cartoon to play in theaters, and eclipses Oswald fairly quickly. And that's, you know, and the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, well, you're right.
he chose to learn from that setback and to figure out how he was going to move forward from that. And I think every one of us should look at that as a life lesson, you know?
I agree. Like Walt said, sometimes you need a good hard failure in order to be able to move forward.
And we all experience those failures, but it's how you deal with those failures is how you're going to succeed in life.
Yeah, I agree. So how can our listeners obtain your book, Find Your Happy Place, The 8-Step Guide to Boosting Your Creativity Through a Personal Retreat?
Well, you can pre-order the book right now at theoldmillpress.com. If you go to theoldmillpress.com, you'll see the book on the landing page under New Releases. It's right there in the middle. Just click on that, and it'll take you to the book page, which will give you more information. You can hear what other people are saying and some of the reviews about the book. And if you want to pre-order it, just click on pre-order, and it'll take you to the Indiegogo campaign. I like to use Indiegogo because it's just a way for people to feel secure about pre-ordering a book months in advance. But in this particular case, the book is done. And if somebody wants a signed copy of it, the book is releasing on September 10th officially, but the signed author copies are going to go out to people in early August. So you have a book a full month before anyone else if you do the pre-order, and you'll get it signed. And so just go to theoldmillpress.com and you can do that. And I will tell you, Michael, this is the best. The book retails for $24.95. Doing the pre-order, you get it for $21, free shipping. Is going to be the best $21 that somebody has invested in themselves. Just think about that, $21. What's that, a couple of Happy Meals?
Now in California, yeah. In California.
but it is, you know, to me, I think this is an investment in yourself. And I hope people get as much out of this book as I've gotten out of the more than 30 years I've been doing it. And you know, the 30 years of experience that I put into writing this book. And I was honestly very thrilled, about your response, about the fact that you and Craig wanted to have me on the show to talk about this book, because it is a little off the beaten path of, Disney. That I've been known for with all my other books, but it's also something that's highly personal to me, and it's something that I really am wanting to share with people, and I wasn't sure how it would be received. So, again, I was happy that you liked it, and on the website, on the book page at theoldmillpress.com, people can read some jacket quotes, if you will, from other people, including business leaders, who've read the manuscript and were kind enough to give me the jacket quotes for the book.
Good. Well, I think we all know the quality of your previous books. I don't think people will be disappointed with this one.
So. I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. Sure. I always strive for value and for quality.
Now, are you working on any other projects that you can talk about right now?
I am always working on other. I have projects, Michael, that go out to 2030. Can you believe that? 2030. I have them on my little sheet of paper that I keep adding to that I add to every time I'm on my personal retreat. But the one I'm going to mention to you, just to tease, is that I'm working on a Disney World War II book.
Okay.
And it's tentatively titled Walt Disney Classified. Animation on Disney animation on the front lines of World War II. And that's going to come out in the fall of 2025. And
that,
I will tell you.
Look forward to that.
I will tell you, I've been working on that book, the research on it, for 25 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I have material in my collection that I believe people have never seen before. Photographs of Walt that I think people have never seen before. And I'm very excited about this book. And, you know, it's a period of Disney history that I don't think has really had much of a deep dive done on it. You know, there's the Richard Schell book, and you know, it's touched on obviously in the Neil Gabler book on Walt Disney, and then there's Donald's Dog Tags, that book. But I don't think anybody's done a deep dive into some of the like classified, the bomb site film, the precision bombing films, you know, some of the training films that the Disney studios did during the war. And these were all, you know, when you talk about the greatest generation, as that generation was dubbed, you know, not only did millions of people go into the military to fight, both in the European theater and the Pacific theater, but you had tens of millions of people on the home front who were all contributing to the war effort. Whether, you know, it was a housewife at home collecting meat drippings and bacon fat to turn in to the butcher, because those things were distilled down into glycerin for munitions, or it was, you know, artists working at the Disney studios, designing insignia, for the various units, of the military. You know, there was just so many facets to the work that the Disney studios did. They did over, by the way, 200 films that were specific to the war effort, whether they be training films, public service announcements, propaganda films, all of those kinds of things. So I'm really touching on a lot of the stuff that you can't find anywhere else.
Like, that'll be fascinating, because I mean, they're referred to in some of the Disney World War II books, but I think the only films people really know are The Fuhrer's Face and right. some of the Donald Duck films, sure. the shorts, and then Victory Through Air Power.
Yeah, and I'm going to touch on Victory Through Air Power, but really I'm not touching on a lot of the entertainment shorts. I'm certainly going to list them, but I'm really going to be talking about stuff that people may not be aware of or have seen before. Or if they've seen it, they don't know anything, you know, behind the stories on it. So, I'm looking forward to it. I'm in the thick of it right now, finishing up the manuscript, and I'm excited about it because there's a lot of really cool stuff in there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So keep us updated on that.
I will. Absolutely. Okay. And you know, you guys, I'm always going to reach out when I have a new book coming out, because I always appreciate both you, Michael, and Craig, for doing your podcast and for having authors like myself on to talk about our books.
Oh, absolutely. It's our pleasure. Yeah. So now you also host a podcast. Can you tell our listeners about that?
I do. It's the Skull Rock Podcast. It's a show that I do with Al John Goh weekly. And we're in our fourth year, which I can't even believe. I know you guys have been doing this for a long time, but, you know, Al John and I got together, in the midst of the pandemic and hatched the idea to do this show. And we really wanted to just do something on Disney and pop culture. And we talk about things that are in the news, and we talk about what we're watching and the movies we've seen. And we always have a special guest every week that we interview, and they tell stories about their career and projects they've worked on. And I think we've had a sort of a rogues gallery of animation personnel on.
Yeah. You have some fantastic guests. I'm very envious.
And you know something? It's always fun for me because I know pretty much all of our guests, and it's just a matter of wrangling them and getting them onto the show to tell their story. And I just enjoy having those conversations because they're such fascinating career paths mm-hmm. and fascinating stories behind some of the animation we all love. You know, I mean, we've had Andreas Deja on, and we've had Dave Spafford and Don Hahn and John Musker, and I've got Ron Clemens coming up. And, you know, there's just so many great people that keep coming on to tell their stories. And I enjoy doing it every single week.
Good, good. Well, yeah. So folks, give Skull Rock a listen. And remember to pick up, you know, get your copy of Find Your Happy Place, the 8-step guide to boosting your creativity through a personal retreat by Dave. And Dave, thank you for joining us on Connecting with Walt. It is always a pleasure to have you.
Michael and Craig, thank you very much. As always, I always appreciate coming on your show and being able to talk to you about all things Disney and sometimes things that aren't quite Disney. So thank you.
Thank you. And now it's time for This Week in Disney History. All right. So, Craig, I think is it my turn this week?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I actually got it right twice in a row now. So, all right. Well, mine is April 15th, 1962. This is probably one of the best known Walt Disney Wonderful World of Color TV episodes. It's episode 208, and it's Disneyland After Dark. And this is, of course, hosted by Walt himself. This is famous for a number of reasons. One is it shows the network debut of the television debut, anyway, the Osmond brothers, Alan J. Merrill and Wayne. Donnie was not yet a part of them. I think he was a little young. But what's cool is in Frontierland, you have the jazz trombonist Louis Armstrong is performing. Annette Funicello and Bobby Burgess are singing a duet with teen idol Bobby Rydell. I think they're in Tomorrowland on the Tomorrowland stage that goes up and down in there. There's a running gag in it where Walt is not able to get to any of the highlighted attractions and performances mm-hmm. because there's so many autograph seekers.
Yeah.
In that one. The Dapper Dans are featured on Main Street. They're singing in Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. So this is so wonderful because you get to see the Disneyland from my era. This is the Disneyland I remember as a boy. And so it's very nostalgic for me to see this. But this is when, you know, like Disneyland had top name performers. We didn't just have DJs. You know, they would have the Dixieland, you know, all through the summer. I remember they would have Dixieland nights where they had famous jazz performers like every week, a different one. And they would, I remember seeing, the Pointer Sisters, you know, there once. And anyway, so it was a really cool era, you know, back then. What was funny is this episode was released theatrically overseas as a short subject. And of course, if you have the DVD, Walt Disney Treasures Disneyland USA series, this episode is included on it. So this, along with probably the one where Walt is talking about the attractions that were at the New York World's Fair and that opened at Disneyland, that's probably the most famous, probably episode of The Wonderful World of Color, and where you get to see the Imagineers and sort of a staged a room that's supposed to be Imagineering. And then there's one that was, I think it was in the 70s, where it was the Osmond brothers, including Donnie, the Haunted Mansion had opened, and it had Kurt Russell. Who is the woman who was the singer? I can't remember. Oh,
putting me on the spot here.
I don't know. I think she was in she was in a musical or something at the time. She was well known at the time. but I can't think of her name. So, but anyway, that's probably another really well-known episode. But
exactly.
But this is, I think, one I enjoy the most is this one where we get to see different aspects of Disneyland.
Yeah, it's definitely up there for me too. I do enjoy the other one with Kurt Russell and the Osmond brothers as well too. But I mean, I could sit down and watch any episode of a Disneyland series and still just be extremely, extremely happy with it. So they're all great.
They are, and it's a shame they don't release more on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I'm still holding out hope for the future on it. What I would love now that, like, you know, I think it was last week that we kind of touched on the Imagineering series that's airing on YouTube now. And I like that first episode that released had Josh D'Amaro doing a nice introduction to it. And, you know, I know Iger's still the CEO of the company, but if Josh D'Amaro ends up in that position, or if even he stays in with the parks and really just embraces that role for the future until maybe his CEO number comes calling one day, I would love to see him take up that mantle, because while I don't think he's perfect and I have some issues with the way that he runs the parks, I think there's no doubt that he is a solid figurehead and he knows how to captivate an audience and a crowd. And I think he could easily be hosting shows and series like this. Whether they live on Disney Plus, YouTube, made it to broadcast, like I could still see this coming back. And he's someone that you would get excited about seeing, like, leading you through the parks and what's new and upcoming and exciting.
I think he has a better presence on a better television presence than Bob Iger does. Bob Iger always felt was a bit stiff.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he tried when, you know, as the special guest with the Golden Mickeys on DCL and some of the television appearances on it, it always came off awkward. That's why I think it's actually disappointing that, you know, whether or not you like Bob Chapek, when he kind of sat down in a room and would talk to you, talk to people, he actually was very engaging and knew how to get on the same level as the people he was talking to. But for some reason, I think, like, every time he made public appearances in a bigger way, he was too afraid of coming off robotic or evil or just in a stressed out position where he didn't know how to handle himself. Cause I think he actually could have done a good job at that too, but not like Josh D'Amaro. He's a natural presence. He walks in a room and he'll make every single person feel important, even if he has no idea who you are.
Yeah. And I did watch that first episode of the Imagineering episode. I don't know what it's called, but it was good. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very well done. Yep. I wanted to see more of the animatronics and thought, oh, show us more. Yeah. And I don't know. Is it releasing every week?
They didn't have a new episode this past week, so maybe it's going to be a little bit more sporadic. And when they have kind of news that they want to push out there, then a new episode will release with it. That's just my best guess, but I was hoping it was going to be a weekly thing.
That's what I was hoping too.
Yeah, or maybe someone just screwed up the scheduling. You know, it's that seems to be my issue too. So I have that problem every now and then.
Alrighty, so what do you have for us this week?
Mine's not super exciting, but something that just caught my eye, and that is all the way back in the year of 2001, April 16th. That's the opening date for Animal Kingdom Lodge, which I just, as soon as I read that and said, wow, we're coming up on that 23rd anniversary this year. Like, I can't believe that hotel is that old now. I don't know. I drift back to the 1990s when I was really, you know, coming to Walt Disney World, and it seemed like new hotels were popping up all the time and there was always something new. And then, you know, you had Animal Kingdom Lodge, and then you had, you know, Pop Century and and art of animation, and it just like it feels like there's been not really a lot, and outside of Riviera and some of the DVC editions, but like
bland,
yeah. But standalone hotels, like it feels like that has just gone away. And you know what though? It's Animal Kingdom Lodge. They made something 23 years ago that was nearly perfect, and it is still nearly perfect to this day. Some of the best dining you'll find at Walt Disney World, you know, right up there with Wilderness Lodge, is one of the best lobby experiences anywhere. And the fact that you can wake up and see animals right outside your room, it'll still never, ever get old for me. So, happy at celebrating not a milestone anniversary, but I'm happy that it's around.
I am too. I think it's probably the most remarkable resort at Walt Disney World, maybe anywhere.
Yeah. So. As much as I love Wilderness Lodge, I feel like, you know, you can get the same kind of style at national parks or at the Grand Californian or even the one in Disneyland Paris that's kind of has a unique feel to it. You know, they're all kind of similar, but Animal Kingdom Lodge, you can make an argument that that is truly, you know, one of a kind, except for maybe there are places like that in Africa that have that same feeling and vibe, but I don't know if I'll ever get there. But at least at a Disney park around the world, Animal Kingdom Lodge is pretty unique.
Yeah, I agree. Seems like the days of the sprawling resorts at Walt Disney World are sort of over now. I mean, maybe not, but those with wonderful theming, you know, and all that. 'Cause they're even retheming some of the existing ones too. Let's say they're just bland. They look like, you know, Hilton hotels on the inside.
Yeah, I think it's going to circle back around where it, you know, I feel like it was an overcorrection based on industry standards. Because I was talking a lot about it for years, because Universal actually started making those changes that Disney eventually made like way before. And that was always like kind of a contentious thing with some Universal people, like, oh, it's not themed enough. It's like, well, that's where hotels are going right now, is towards a more stripped down, modern, more, you know, make something that's easy to maintain and doesn't look out of date so quickly. And I think Disney did go too far in the other direction. And I think we're going to start seeing that drift back towards like, okay, let's find that nice balance now between the two. Bring in touches, bring in that theming and style, but it doesn't have to be so over the top that, yeah, it's, you know, they get changed up and refreshed every 7 years, but sometimes you're like, oh, after 2 years, these hotels look like they're already ancient. So I think there's a medium there, and they'll figure it out.
Right. I hope you're right, because that's not what people want from Disney hotels. Maybe from the hotels at the airports or in downtown city areas, but not at Disney.
I don't think it plagues all of Disney either, because like when Animal Kingdom Lodge was refreshed, I forget when it was, like the rooms that you currently can stay in Animal Kingdom Lodge, I mean, they have all the touches that a Disney room has now, the raised beds so you can store luggage under, non-carpeted floors, but Animal Kingdom Lodge is still so full of Disney theme and charm and touches that make you know you're there. Same thing with Wilderness Lodge, and out in California, you know, the refresh of the Grand Californian I thought was done so tastefully. And actually I did not like Grand Californian until they did the remodel, and now I love it there. And I haven't seen the Pixar Place hotel yet, but that looks so whimsical and fun and feels like it is. I think that's the medium that I was talking about, where any pictures I've seen of it, videos I've seen of it, it looks like they put in a lot of theming there, but still add a little style and finesse to it. And meanwhile, as much as I love the Disneyland hotel rooms, the last couple times I've stayed there, I'm like, well, these need refresh. They are feeling dated. So I think they're on the right direction. And you can see that in some of the hotels. Just others, they got a little too aggressive.
Yeah. So Anyway, do you think we're talking about Universal? Do you believe Bob Iger when he said that they've been planning for 10 years for Epic Universe?
No.
No, I no. don't either.
I think that some of the points I've seen made are like what he meant was that they knew that eventually Universal was going to grow and do bigger and better things. And they could see that that was the direction they were going from the first two Wizarding Worlds, and that they weren't going to slow down with that. They're going to continue on. And so that's why they started to bolster their parks. I totally believe that's what he probably meant by it is, yeah, we, of course they were going to do something someday. And that's why we developed everything we did to try to combat that a little bit. But there's not anything that they've done, I think, that really is a solid plan of attack against a park that was announced, what, in 2019? And by that point in time, all of Galaxy's Edge was open at that point. So there was nothing that really they've developed since then to kind of fight it off, you know, outside of Tron, which has been in the works for years and years, and Tiana's Bayou Adventure now. But that's still little stuff. It's going to be D23 Expo, the stuff we're going to learn about with what truly is coming beyond Big Thunder Mountain and what, you know, what's coming to Animal Kingdom. That's going to be the stuff that makes the difference. In my opinion, it doesn't need to be a new gate that gets people excited. If they are talking about serious expansions that now warrant you to say, okay, I need to spend 2 to 3 days at Magic Kingdom, or I need a day and a half at Animal Kingdom, then right there, you're going to start chipping away at time down the road at Universal. And I think that's what they want more than anything. They don't need to make a splash with a brand new park. They just need people to want to stay in their parks longer.
Yeah, that's true. So speaking of Magic Kingdom, there's rumors that have hit the Disney interwebs this week that all seem to stem from one site about the Frontierland rumor. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
Do you think there's any truth to this at all?
I have mixed feelings about it. I believe you're talking about Mickey Views with yes. That's kind of pushing all of it. And
it just seems like they're just dumping IP in there with no overall theme.
Yeah, here's the thing. I know Braden that runs Mickey Views. He obviously has great contacts. He scours message boards to see where hints might be dropping from people secretly. I don't think he's putting it out there because it's a guess. I think it was probably timed to when there is some solidity to it. And knowing that, you know, we're a couple months before D23 Expo, they have to start coming up with those plans that, like, yeah, we're ready to announce this and that. And, you know, if we're talking about 6 years ago or so, we're talking about that's WDWNT. That's the one spoiling everything before D23 mm-hmm. Expo. So could it be him in this case now being the one to do it? It certainly could be, but we just have to, wait and see. But I don't think these types of things just get made up out of nowhere. I think they're coming from somewhere. The only thing to me that's really kind of out of left field with any of it is Cars Land being involved. And I understand where that technically could fit in thematically, but I mean, the Cars Land stuff has been going back all the way to when I first started with the Diz, and when Hollywood Studios was having rumblings of, okay, they're about ready to start a big epic expansion, and they're going to potentially do Star Wars. They're going to potentially do this. They're going to potentially get rid of the back lot and do Radiator Springs there. It's always been kind of in the air. And I'm not solid and sure on that one, but I it also wouldn't surprise me. It's stuff that they can easily make quickly.
I know. It just seems like it's just a mishmash. There's no story, overall story. There's no nothing in that. It just, I think it would just be a shame. People would love it because they don't care about story. You know, the average guest probably doesn't care about story.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm counting on.
Yeah. Here's the hard part. There's a lot of great people still in Imagineering, and I don't know if there's also enough people asking the right questions with it, but like, based on how it was thrown out there with the different IPs and having like the Bayou part of the frontier and then, you know, the Route 66 part of the frontier, even though that doesn't fit in with the same time period, there's the only thing that really doesn't make sense to me is with villains back there. Right. And like, it's a stretch on some parts, but honestly, I've talked about it on our Walt Disney World show. I'm okay with just changing the entire idea of Frontierland, not for any specific reason. I think it's almost too broad. I think Frontierland has kind of hit the same, at least in Magic Kingdom, not talking about Disneyland. Disneyland's, I feel like Frontierland is a smaller area, but still a cohesive story, where Magic Kingdom's doesn't make sense and is being thrust into even more nonsensical ways now that you have Tiana's Bayou Adventure opening up. It messes that even more. So I'd be okay with Frontierland, the idea of it going away completely at Magic Kingdom and figuring out new lands that still have that same resonance as a Frontierland, Adventureland, Tomorrowland, etc. But, you know, something new in that way. It doesn't click. I mean, even with the way they're redoing Country Bear Jamboree, like, that doesn't feel Frontier anymore. If you get rid of the shooting gallery, it's another step away. And I know we can still make the argument, well, you have Rivers of America and you have Tom Sawyer Island, but that's rumored to be on the chopping block too. So if that goes away but if you still have the rivers, our river boat landing isn't in Frontierland, it's in Liberty Square, so technically you can keep that. So if you change Country Bear Jamboree, if you change Pecos Bill, if you get rid of the shooting gallery, what is left of Frontierland really at that point, besides Big Thunder off in the distance and you know, the leftover pieces that don't really connect together?
Yeah, I just hate that they just figure they can dump any IP in there that's sort of Western themed and it'll tell a story of some sort.
Yeah, it's they can always make up new stories. That's the thing. That's what people get paid to do, is find a way to tie it in even when it can't. So it's whether or not we want to accept it, that's up to us and, you know, our prerogative, but they're always going to come up with new stories that fit in whether or not we like it.
Yeah, yeah. And then I wish, well, why not at least come up with new attractions? This thing of having the same attractions on both coasts are just, you know, come up with something that would want us here in the West to go to the East and vice versa. Well,
that's where I don't believe that part of it, because I feel like they started to step away with that a little bit and say, let's make unique stuff on both coasts. So, because, you know, even with the Disneyland Forward, the Avatar artwork from last week, that looks completely different from our Pandora. So that's where I get kind of nervous with rumors swirling around too, that, you know, it doesn't make sense. Everywhere Imagineering was going was, okay, if we bring stuff in from overseas, from, you know, bringing something in from Shanghai, that's okay because it's a little different. Everything that, you know, I feel like people are talking about with Indiana Jones Adventure potentially taking over our dinosaur, I always was of the mindset, if it's the same exact ride track, it's going to be the same ride. But apparently there's like one or two small parts of it with how it was constructed in as Dinosaur that wouldn't work as a complete clone of Indiana Jones Adventure at California. So it does have to be a little bit different. So I feel like the mindset is still try to be as unique as possible and not just clone both coasts anymore, but you know, they could easily go back to that if they had to. I mean, I still feel like Tiana's Bayou Adventure, while it opens up on both coasts, I think they have to be a little bit unique, because really both Splash Mountains were unique. They were different enough, and you know, it might just have been about where animatronics were placed or speed, but even the music was slightly different. Like, we didn't have in our Laughing Place, we didn't have the one bunny that was singing about ominous things right before you started going up the hill.
Oh yeah,
that was in Disneyland. There was a good amount. So I think Tiana's is going to be the same way, where same general idea, but you have to experience it on both coasts to see how it actually differs. And I'm okay with that.
I mean, at least it'd be different. That'll be good. So, well, Craig, until next time, how can our listeners connect with you?
Well, as always, you can find me on different shows on the Diz Unlimited podcast network. You can find me on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Teleclaster, and you can email me, craig@disneyinfo.com.
You can send me messages at michaelbowling@disneyinfo.com. On Twittix, I'm at mbowling121. Facebook, Michael Bowling - Connecting with Walt. Instagram, Michael Bowling the Diz. And you can connect with me and Craig on Twitter at Connecting Walt. If you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes on the link Craig includes in our episode description. And look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, Pandora, and Amazon podcasts, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings when possible. So thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother, Roy.